All right, we made rushed through Nehemiah chapter 2 last week, so I just want to very briefly go back because it sets us up for what's going to happen in chapter 3. Chapter 3 is one of those chapters, on the surface it can be very boring, but I enjoy studying it a lot, and I think you'll see why as we get to the discussion of that chapter. It's one of those chapters that's got a bunch of names in it and some of the monotonous, repetitive details that's easy to get bogged down in. Sometimes the temptation when you're reading through that is just to kind of say, okay, you're seeing the same words repeated, to just kind of bust through and look for any words that may stand out to you and grab onto that, but otherwise just kind of read through to just get done with that part so you can move on to something more interesting. And chapter 4, to me, is certainly one of the more interesting. But with that being said, I think we're going to find some interesting things. I hope I'll be able to bring out some interesting things from Nehemiah chapter 3 that will give you some appreciation for that. So just to kind of recap the material that we flew through last week. In chapter 2, Nehemiah leaves Babylon. He gets permission from the king to return to the city of Jerusalem because word had been brought to him that the walls were falling down and that the city wasn't rebuilt. And so the king gives him permission to go back, and he prepares all of the things he needs, and he makes the trip back. Verses 9 through 20 is really what we hasten through. And what happens there is, after Nehemiah is back in the city of Jerusalem, what he does, and you're going to see there are some, Nehemiah is a natural-born leader. He acts with a great degree of wisdom. He acts with a great degree of discernment. And you're just going to notice throughout the course of this book how he just steps into positions and he makes wise decisions and he handles things in a manner that present the least degree of trouble. And so there's a lot of things we can learn him just regarding leadership and inspiring others and giving the work of the Lord everything you've got. But what he does when he gets there, he's going to be very careful because, as we're going to see, he's going to face some opposition. In fact, that's immediately what happened in the first part of chapter 2. A couple of characters named Tobiah and Sanballat came up and began threatening him. Okay, they're already applying this political pressure. So Nehemiah is governor of the region of Jerusalem and the surrounding area in Judea, and he's surrounded by enemies on the north and on the east and on the south and on the west. And they're going to really come together, and they're going to apply political pressure. They're going to apply the threat of enemy forces. Okay, so they're going to have to be on guard for attacks. And just the way that Nehemiah handles this whole procedure is very wise. And God certainly brought up the right man to take on this task and rebuild the city walls in Jerusalem. So what he does in the second part of chapter 2 is, covertly at night, he goes out and he travels around the city walls to just check out the state of the various walls and the various gates and to see how things are. And so after he does that at night, nobody really knows what's going on. He goes back the next day and he gathers the people together and he's like, this is what I've seen and this is going to be the plan how we're going to go about rebuilding the city walls. So they know the work is enormous that's in front of them, but he encourages them. He builds them up in the Lord. And he says, let us rise up and build. And that's exactly what's going to happen. Now, chapter 3 is largely just a summary of the work as a whole. Chapters 4 through 6 talk about the opposition that they face. So chapter 3 is just an overview of what happens. And chapters 4 through 6 kind of recount some of the struggles and some of the challenges that they faced as they were rebuilding the wall. So that kind of gives you an idea. It's not exactly chronological order. In chapter 3 just covers the whole rebuilding from start to finish. And then chapters 4 through 6 highlight some of the problems and the challenges they faced and then how they dealt with that. So that just kind of gives you hopefully an idea of what these chapters are about. So chapter 3 has some of those hard-to-read names and hard-to-read places. Any volunteers for reading any of chapter 3? We may not read all of it verse by verse, but I do want to kind of highlight some of this because I find these names to be significant, and we'll talk about maybe the significance of them after we get through the chapter.
Kathy and I listened to it on the way home from Little Rock.
You know, that probably...
English dude that was pronouncing those words that he got every one of your parts.
Get your phone, and I'm going to put it in front of the microphone, and I'm going to hit play, all right? Is that okay? Can we do that? All right. Tell you what, all right, I'll go first, and maybe my poor attempt will embolden some other poor soul to volunteer. David, you want to do a little bit of reading? All right, let me see. Tell you what, let's read, if you would read for us verses 1 through 5, please, of chapter 3.
Elijah the high priest was of the to him, building the men of Jericho, next to him, building the Zeker, the son of Emery. Fishgate did the sons of Hezekiah build, who also lived in Bing thereof, set up the door thereof, locked thereof, the bar thereof. Next to them prepared Meremoth, the son of Uriah, Uriah, the son of God. Next to them prepared Eshelam, the son of Urukiah, the son of Ekazadil. And next to them prepared Zadok, the son of Manah. And next to them the Tekwise prepared their nobles, but not their next to work with them.
All right. Was that David by chance that you heard reading on the way home? It wasn't him.
It didn't sound like him.
Well, that was a pretty good rendition of the first five verses there. So some of these names can be kind of tough to work through. Thank you, David, for reading that. The reason I find chapter 3 so interesting is, let me see if I just have this up there. There we go. We talk a lot about the city of Jerusalem, and what chapter 3 does is it just kind of takes you in a circuitous route around the city where they're rebuilding the walls. And so part of what I want to do tonight is to talk a little bit about the city of Jerusalem itself. Now, when you're dealing with events that took place this long ago, archaeologically, which is how you go about validating a lot of things that the Scripture says, some of this we just have to take at face value because archaeologically, all of this hasn't been proven. There have been various things that have been discovered, various discoveries that have been made, but we can't recreate exactly what Jerusalem looked like during the times of Nehemiah, much less during the time of David. So remember, David conquered Jerusalem from the Jebusites, and he made it the capital city in all of Israel. And throughout the course of David and Solomon's reign, and even further beyond, the city of Jerusalem itself was expanded. But through what has been discovered archaeologically, scholars have use that information between what we have here, say, in Nehemiah 3, and the archaeological evidence that has been discovered, they've made a good guess, at what the city of Jerusalem may have looked like and where the various gates were positioned throughout the course of the city. So you can find people that will argue various locations here. This is just this particular picture that I found seemed to give a pretty good depiction. At least it followed relatively well. It tracked pretty well with the various gates and the rebuildings of chapter 3. So I just went with that. I wouldn't take this for gospel, but with that being said, I just want us to kind of have an idea of what the city of Jerusalem looked like, and maybe we can gain some appreciation for that. As you can tell from the key, Jerusalem was not a very big city. I've seen scholarly estimations that said Jerusalem might be anywhere from about 30 acres to as much to 220 acres at this point in time. Now, it's since been recently expanded, actually on multiple occasions, I believe. And today, if you go over there, the population is 874,000. However, it wasn't near that big during the days of David and during the days of Nehemiah. So this kind of gives you a decent idea, perhaps, of how the city walls would have been rebuilt under Nehemiah's leadership. A couple of notable names that jump out of us that we read in verse 1, Eliashib, he is the grandson of Jeshua. Jeshua was the high priest, you remember, during the days of Zerubbabel. So he came back with Zerubbabel during the first group remnant to return. He was the high priest, one of the spiritual leaders during that time. So Eliashib is there and he's working among them. He's spoken of in verse 1. Another interesting group of people in verse 5 is the Tekoites. Tekoa was a small town. It was about 5 miles out south of Bethlehem. Does anybody recall a biblical person in the Old Testament that was from the city of Tekoa? Very good. Amos. Okay, Amos the prophet was from the city of Tekoa. Now, Tekoa doesn't appear in the list of the people that were returned with Zerubbabel. And a couple of things could have happened. It could have been some people resettled there, or it could have been some of the nobles and aristocrats who disdained the manual labor, refused to assist in the rebuilding. And that's really what jumps out at you in verse 5. The Tekoites repaired a certain portion of the wall, but verse 5 says their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. So I think we're going to find out more why it is the nobles refused to help and assist with the building of the wall, at least the portion of the wall that their people did. And that'll become evident. At first, our guess is, well, they're nobles, and so maybe they don't want to get their hands dirty. They're not used to that kind of hard work. What we're going to find out is that isn't the case. Everybody, pretty much from the top to the bottom, helps rebuild the city wall. We're going to see, rather, that they've made some sort of political alliance with one of the enemies. And that's the reason that they're likely refraining from helping. When you jump down to verse 27, near the end of the chapter, after him the Tekoites repaired another section opposing the great projecting tower as far as the wall of Ophel. So the Tekoites did double duty because their nobles wouldn't stoop to help and wouldn't engage in any of the work. So not only did they rebuild that one portion of the wall, but they rebuilt a second portion of the wall because their nobles shirked their responsibility. And if you jump down to verse 12, it wasn't just the men that were hard at work. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halohesh, ruler of half of the district of Jerusalem, repaired he and his daughters. Okay, so like I said, this is really an all hands on deck kind of project. Everybody from the high priest family all the way down to the women, everybody is involved in this. Nobody shirked their responsibility with the exception of the nobles of Tekoa. So let's try to just talk about some of the highlights, some of the notable places that are mentioned here, and maybe give you some familiarity with the city of Jerusalem. It's such a prominent place, and I found several of these details to be rather interesting as I was preparing through this chapter and studying and looking at it. So he starts at the perimeter of Jerusalem, and he's going to go counterclockwise around. And just as he's listing the rebuilding, this is the order that he goes. So he's really going to start here, I think, with the sheep gate and then just go all the way around the city and kind of list the rebuilding in that direction. The sheep gate is the first thing that's mentioned in verse 1. That was located in the northeastern part of the city. And, I meant to print out some copies so everybody could see these because this is interesting. But it's right there, the northeast portion of the city of Jerusalem. And you have very near that the temple and the altar. So you can imagine why this is referred to as the sheep gate. The sheep that were destined to be offered in the temple would be brought in through that particular gate. And that's why it was given that name, that were going to be sacrificed. And also located there is what's called the Pool of Bethesda. Now, we find reference to that in John chapter 5 and verse 2. If memory serves right, the Pool of Bethesda was where the lame man was laying, and the angels were said to have stirred the water, and the first person down was believed to have been healed of whatever ailment or malady that they were suffering from, and he's never able to be first in the water, and Jesus comes along and heals them. That's where the Pool of Bethesda is located. It's up there by the sheep gate, and during this time, I believe the Pool of Bethesda was used for washing the sheep as they were brought in before they were taken and before they were sacrificed. Now, unsurprisingly, this section is oversaw by who? Well, it's oversaw by the high priest. This would kind of be their territory. And that's what you're going to find is the individuals who worked in a specific location, they usually worked there for a particular reason. It may be that their house was located close to that part of the wall, but each one kind of takes a designated area as their own. And the priest and his family take this area by the sheep gate because that would be a work that they were very much involved in. Mentioned in the same statement in verse 1 is the Tower of the Hundred, or the Tower of Mia, some call it, and the Tower of Hananel. I guess that's how you say that. So you see the sheep gate right there, and these two little pillar-looking things there are the Tower of Hananel and the Tower of Mia. Now, Jerusalem, as you know, was a very fortified city, and geographically it was protected on the west, on the south, and on the east. Its most vulnerable location was there on the north. And that's the reason that those two watchtowers were placed there at the very north of the city, because the city of Jerusalem opened up to the central Benjamin Plateau, and that was just where the enemy, topographically could come, because it was protected on the other sides. And so if you're going to attack Jerusalem, you would attack it from the north. And so they put those two towers there to allow people to watch, guards to watch, and to keep an eye out in the event that someone would come and would attack them from that direction. natural valley topography. That's where they were protected from on the other side. So remember, the city of Jerusalem is set on a hill, Mount Zion, as it's called. And because of that, it was hard to attack from any direction but the north. And so that's why those towers were there. The rest of the perimeter of the city was protected. Kind of a special note to think about. This was also a very common gate for the people to travel out of. And if you think about the significance of Jesus walking through, entering Jerusalem through the sheep gate, where the sheep were brought to be taken to the temple and ultimately be sacrificed, you know that had to resonate with him. All of those times he would have entered Jerusalem in through the sheep gate. Behold the Lamb of God. So from there you kind of go west and you have the fish gate. Don't worry, we won't have near this much for all of the rest. The sheep gate was one of the more notable places. The fish gate was known in the days of the first temple. It was another one of the main entrances to the city. It's called the fish gate because the merchants from Tyre and the other coastal towns would bring oftentimes fish in. The fish were imported into Jerusalem from Tyre and maybe even from as far north as Galilee. Okay, and so since that would be where the merchants would come in and then set up their wares, that was referred to as the fish gate. From there, you had the valley gate, which is mentioned in verse 13. I'm going to assume, no, valley gate is down there in the southwest, okay, southwest corner. And the reason it was called the valley gate is because it was facing the Teropian Valley. And then in verse 14, you have a mention of the dung gate. That's kind of there in the southeast. And that was that led to the Hinnom Valley. You may recognize the name of the Hinnom Valley. That was where they would oftentimes carry their garbage to essentially throw out. You know, the Valley of Hinnom was there. And you know, I think that's translated into the Greek, from the Hebrew into the Greek, the Valley of Gehenna. Gehenna being the word that's rendered hell because of the fire that was always burning there because of the trash that people always took out. So this was unsurprisingly referred to as the dung gate. That's where the people would exit to take their trash. And that's where the people long ago sacrificed their children to Molech. And that's where the garbage would have been disposed of. So just a little bit north of that, still on the southeast side, you have the fountain gate facing the Kidron Valley. And when you go back and you look at chapter 2 and verse 14, this is possibly the most damaged part of the wall. Chapter 2:14 says, "Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass." So that was obviously a pretty destroyed section of the city. Not all of the city was destroyed to the same degree, but Nebuchadnezzar tore down the walls and burned various parts, thus complicating the rebuild and destroying the city. So it would be harder for the people to build back. Near that was the pool of Siloam, and you can kind of see that there. So fountain gate's right there. So you got the pool of Siloam there and the lower pool in that area, thus the term the fountain gate. And anyone recall what the pool of Siloam significant for in the New Testament? Wasn't that where the blind man was sent to wash? Okay, Jesus rubbed the mud on his eyes and said, "Go wash at the pool of Siloam, and you'll be able to see." So that was right there by the fountain gate. And not only that, but you could access the Gihon spring from there. This was the primary water source of the city of Jerusalem. So you have the pools there, and you have access to the Gihon spring there. And a little bit north of the fountain gate is the water gate, and that gives you an almost direct access to the Gihon Springs there.
I think the Gihon Springs, Hezekiah's home, mm-hmm. went into Siloam.
Yes. In fact, it's hard to see this little dotted line right there. It's labeled, and I didn't do near as much reading on Hezekiah's tunnel, but it's labeled as Hezekiah's aqueduct, and it looks like it's connecting the pool of Siloam to the Gihon Spring. So that was a way for fresh water to be brought into the city, right, in the event of a siege or something of that nature. So, yeah, good observation. So, yeah, that's Hezekiah's tunnel, that aqueduct that connects the Gihon Spring to the pool of Siloam. From there, you'll go even farther north to the Horse Gate. So now you're in the area in which the area of the city in which the king lived, and that was on the palace grounds, likely situated near the stables of Solomon, which was said to hold 12,000 horses. This was also the place where Athaliah was seized at the temple and taken to the entrance of the Horse Gate and executed. She was grandmother to Joash, I believe, and she took over the throne and reigned for several years in Jerusalem. When she was finally dethroned and executed, they killed her near the Horse Gate. So 12 gates in all: Sheep Gate, Fish Gate, Gate of Yeshana, Valley Gate, Dung Gate, Fountain Gate, Water Gate, Horse Gate, East Gate, and Muster Gate. So that's 10. Nobody's counting, but that's 10. There's two other gates that are mentioned later on. That's the Gate of Ephraim in chapter 8 and verse 16, and the Prison Gate in chapter 12 and verse 39. So that leaves you with a total of 12 gates. Now, John makes this observation in Revelation chapter 21, verses 12 and 13, as he writes about the New Jerusalem. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates the name of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed, on the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. So 12 gates in the city of Jerusalem, and John, as he is describing the New Jerusalem, not even going to take a guess at what that is, he describes a city, heavenly city, with 12 gates there as well. So just a couple of maybe observations and a question or two about the rebuilding. With the exception of the nobles of Tekoa, everybody pitched in rebuilding, from the high priest to the goldsmith to the perfumers to the women, to accomplish this task. And so what we see is everyone was involved. And when you think about the work of the Lord, isn't that just a good picture of what the work of the Lord is like? It's not just for a few people. It's for all of us. No one is too unimportant to work, and no one is too important to work. So God gives each of us unique abilities to do the work that He's assigned us to. And there's going to come a time, Paul says, when our work is going to be tested. Okay, it's going to stand under the judgment of God. And whether our work stands or whether our work falls, we'll be rewarded for that. So we also see that this was largely accomplished through the good leadership of Nehemiah and the good hand of God. So let me just ask one question before we move on to chapter 4, and we just may not have much time for that. Why might Nehemiah have specifically named those who help rebuild the city wall? Okay, documentation of the faithful. Is there anything like that today? Spiritually, maybe? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of where I was going. I can see how that might be a stretch to connect what you were saying to where I was going. But yeah, I think that's one of the lessons that we learn here, is that God knows who's working, and God knows who's not working. It was observed who was willing to help, and it was observed who was not willing to help. And to this day, the Lord knows that are working, those who are working, and He knows those who aren't, and He's keeping a record of those who serve Him. He's keeping a record of their service. Yes, Robert?
A historical account would also be encouragement to the next generations to follow.
Yeah.
You know, if their grandfather was listed as served, you would make you want to.
Yeah. But if you're from the noble family of Tekoa, then you move somewhere else. You don't live in the city of Jerusalem. But you're right, and the Jews were big on that, keeping records, just to keep an account of the things that had been done. And that's what you see. You see names mentioned throughout the course of this, and you go back and what was it? Well, we're actually going to get there later in Nehemiah, and it's going to be a chapter we largely skip because it's really just a repeat from Ezra chapter 2, which is just a name of all of the people that came back. But the Jews were big on that. They were big on keeping the records as to who did what. And yeah, that would be something to be proud of whenever you look back and you saw your family's names represented well in the rebuilding of the city. Good observation. All right. And just one more thought to add to that. There is no work that is insignificant or forgotten. So God sees, God takes note, God knows. And I think that should inspire all of us, shouldn't it, to be diligent in the work that God has given us to do. not to, to shirk any responsibility that we have, to take the good jobs and take the jobs that aren't so good, and don't be like the nobles of Tekoa who refuse to put their hand to the plow. And that's what the work of the Lord takes, is people who are willing to get their hands dirty, and this would be dirty, hard work. Tommy?
Yeah, I don't care if we're talking about 30 acres, 100 acres of water. They wouldn't build the five wires to pop the water.
No. Right. Yeah, I mean, they didn't build walls that short. I mean, this would have to be something. If somebody could just come and jump over that, you know, no problem. So they would have to build these walls, and it's impressive when you see how quickly they get this done. Anybody know off the top of their head how long it took them to rebuild the wall from start to finish? That's what's coming to mind for me. 52 is the number that's in my head, and I could be wrong about that. Let me see. You know, I really don't want to find out that I might be wrong about that. But it took them a very short period of time to complete this. And this is because the people were willing to work, because everyone was pitching in, and because God was with them. So we'll talk about some of the challenges that they're going to face. Chapter 4 is a great chapter. It's going to deal with some of the opposition that they face. Chapter 5 is going to deal with some of the social and the economic troubles that come about. And then Chapter 6 are going to be some more scare tactics by Sanballat and Tobiah. So anyone else have any thoughts, comments, or questions they'd like to... Yes, sir.
You say that Solomon's house, 12,000.
I'm wanting to say that's what the record was.
Well, if it was.
Right. And yeah, in that account, it could have been the 12,000. You know, you have to look how they reckoned it. They might have said Solomon had 12,000 house to Jerusalem, but it equally could have meant that he had stables all throughout the area of Israel, and it totaled 12,000. So I can't remember where exactly I grabbed that detail from. I'll look and see if I can find out and give you a little more answer next time, John. Yeah, that's a good observation.
I mentioned Nehemiah's prayer being played out. They built that wall.
Yeah, yeah. You're gonna see several prayers that are answered that Nehemiah offers in the course of the rebuilding of the wall. He was a man of prayer, so that's also a lesson for us. Yeah, we're gonna see that in chapter 4. So, hammer in one hand, sword in the other. So, chapter 4 is a great chapter. I'm looking forward to being able to study it together. So, thank you tonight for your comments and your observations and attention.